Well, I'd like to welcome everyone to the second year of OPASI Rounds and our first meeting, and I'm really thrilled that our speaker today really needs no introduction, and particularly as I look around this room, needs no introduction. But I'm really thrilled that Dwayne is going to speak to us today. It's a really opportune time in that there's so many legislative and other initiatives going on for children's health. We're really trying to highlight this for the other institutes and centers who have children's missions and to understand the opportunity for trans NIH approaches and to work together. So the not new director, but the director of the new Eunice Kennedy Shriver Institute, Dr. Alexander, thank you for being here.
Alan, thanks very much. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to do this. I took the liberty of bringing a lot of my own audience along. I think it's probably a good thing. But they're a pretty informed audience, but there are others here who have heard about NCS or have been participating in it in various ways, and some of the other pediatric initiatives too. So I hope that the timeliness of this, because of its coming at the time when there are many new pediatric initiatives coming along from various sources, from institutes, from the roadmap activities, or from legislation from Congress, that you really should be aware of and hopefully take advantage of by participating in them in various ways. So why, you might ask, why this is an OPASI-related topic? And that's a legitimate question. It's, I hope, not just because Alan had a slot to fill and nobody else would take it. So anyway, I'm here. But it really is OPASI-related. There's a good rationale for this. Because across the NIH, pediatric research really needs to speed translation of new discoveries into clinical practice. And that should sound pretty familiar to you because that is part of NIH and part of OPASI. To do this, we need to access well-characterized cohorts of patients and services. We need to focus on multidisciplinary teams and networks to develop large, coordinated resource-sharing pediatric settings, and to harmonize our approaches, build the infrastructure, and create networks to carry this work out. And these are interests that are shared across many of the institutes. Pediatric research needs are trans-NIH issues. The pediatric work is a key to understanding all disease processes, giving us an enhanced understanding of developmental processes, beginning at the molecular level and beginning at birth or before and continuing throughout the lifespan. We need to develop child-appropriate drugs and dosing schedules and therapeutic methodologies and delivery systems and devices across the whole spectrum of pediatric diseases and develop model systems and repositories and shared databases to help with this research. We also need to access pediatric populations for our work and develop special resources and harmonize these aspects. And we need appropriately trained multidisciplinary teams. I'm going to be talking today about six initiatives and activities that are going on at the present time that all have are relatively recent in onset. The oldest of these is the National Children's Study. The newest is the Newborn Screening Initiative under congressional legislation, which is just in the last several months. So I'm going to spend most of the time on the National Children's Study, but I'm also going to be addressing the other topics as well. The National Children's Study is the largest long study of children's health and development that's ever been conducted anywhere. It's a longitudinal study of children and their families and their environments from birth and actually before birth until age 21. In keeping with the charge from the Congress, environment will be construed broadly, and we will study about 100,000 children to have large enough population to study important but not real common outcomes as well as more common ones. And the National Children's Study was eventually mandated by the Congress, but this is one of those times when they directed us to do something that we really wanted to do anyway. It has its origin really in 1998 when President Clinton appointed a secretarial-level task force on environmental health risks and safety risks to children and charged them with developing strategies to reduce these risks in children. Donna Shalala and Carol Browner chaired the task force. It had seven other cabinet-level members on it, and, as usual, work was conducted by the senior staff. They worked for a year, and their major conclusion was that environmental health concerns were serious and needed to be taken seriously, but the current science base was not sufficient to make recommendations. And what we really needed, and needed badly, was a longitudinal study of the effects of environmental exposures on children's health and development. We had a consultation with the scientific community in 2000 that basically endorsed the concept for this study, said that it needed to be large, it needed to be bold, it needed to involve multiple agencies, and it needed to have partnerships with the public and the private sector as well. It also noted right from the start that new money would be needed for a study of this magnitude. This conclusion was based in part on the fact that there were numerous known examples of environmental effects harmful to children. Perhaps the oldest and best known of these was lead exposure, its effect on cognitive development, but also more recent ones about fetal alcohol syndrome, about radiation in relation to malignancy, about mercury and developmental delay, diethylstilbestrol and causing vaginal cancer in females and male reproductive tract anomalies, and the thalidomide scare of the 1960s related to birth defects. There was enough here to suspect that there might be others. And so part of the rationale of this study was that children are particularly vulnerable, and there may well be other concerns, other exposures that are harmful above and beyond these. Leading suspects among this group were pesticides, PCBs, violence, and media. But these suspects were linked to things like autism, to birth defects, to learning disabilities, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, diabetes, and asthma, to cite just a few examples. However, the existing research, though suggestive, was inconsistent and too limited in size and scope to build a reliable program on, and it was felt that a longitudinal study over the life course was needed to correctly link these multiple exposures and multiple outcomes and be able to determine cause and effect relationships rather than just associations. It's also felt that this was an appropriate time to do these studies. Back in the 1950s and 60s, many environmental factors have been introduced since then in terms of chemicals and air, food and water, and so forth, so that our exposures to these environmental substances and their interaction with the genetic constitution has been much expanded over what it used to be. Also, since the 1950s, we've developed technology advances that have allowed us to use biomarkers, to the mapping of the human genome, better computer data management, and microanalytic capabilities so that a study like this becomes feasible. It's urgent to do it now in order to get answers to these concerns about some disorders where we have really no other postulates about what the causes might be that are reasonable, and also because we have to try to get answers to these while we can. So the Congress listened to the recommendations of this task force, and in 2000, they passed the Children's Health Act with specific provision authorizing the NICHD to lead and conduct a national longitudinal study of environmental influences on children's health and development, with environment broadly defined. They specifically charged the director of NICHD with establishing a consortium of representatives from their federal agencies, citing specifically CDC and EPA, to plan, to develop, and implement a prospective cohort study starting from birth and going to adulthood to evaluate the effects of both chronic and intermittent exposures on child health and human development, including looking for mechanisms. So this was the law. It was provided a very clear mandate, and it included implementation. We have had the good fortune and, in fact, the luxury of having 8 years to plan for this very large and complex study. In doing so, we've involved an interagency coordinating committee from the lead responsible agencies, as well as a federal chartered advisory committee of outside scientists and lay members and advocates. We've had 22 different working groups on various parts of the study, a federal consortium involving more than 40 agencies, as well as teams of center investigators and the program staff working on all this, in total of over 3,000 scientists involved in various aspects of the planning for this study. From all this work has evolved a group of concepts about this study. It will define the environment broadly, as the Congress directed. It will be hypothesis-driven, not a fishing expedition. Collect all the data and then see what you're going to do with it. It's observational and not interventional. The exposure begins with pregnancy and goes through age 21. We will have the power to detect high-priority conditions requiring a number of an N of about 100,000. We will use state-of-the-art technology to measure influences and outcomes. We will pay particular attention to studies on gene-environment interactions. We'll involve a consortium of many federal agencies with public-private partnerships as well, and the data will provide a rich resource for future studies. I said it's going to be hypothesis-driven. Here are some examples of some hypotheses that we will test. The health and developmental effects of persistent low-level chemical exposures. The asthma incidence of severity being influenced by interaction of early life infection and air quality. How does high-level exposure to media content of different types in early childhood affect development and behavior? And what about pre- and postnatal exposures to endocrine active environmental agents? How does this affect pubertal development? These are just four examples. There are now over 60 hypotheses that the study will be addressing, and there are many others that can be developed in association with interests of the various institutes. I said we're going to be looking at both exposures and outcomes. These are some of the types of exposures and categories that we'll be looking at in particular, and the types of outcomes that we'll be looking at as well. So virtually all the data collection is linked to try and study some particular outcome of interest in relationship to the hypotheses. We will have a wide variety of sample collections over the course of the study. We'll start with DNA, with cord blood. We'll also get samples from the mother and father and any siblings. This will be stored for future analyses for the most part. We'll also collect environmental samples from various settings, from the home, from the school, from daycare site, and look also for biomarkers in blood, in breast milk, hair, other tissues. Some of these will have to be analyzed right away because they're not stable. Others can be stored for future use. We'll get an interview in history. We'll be using in particular the NHGRI history exam, looking for genetic relationships. We'll also look at cognitive measures, at serology and medical data, housing and living characteristics and social experiences and characteristics of the neighborhood. One of the major decisions that the planning process had to make was the way we select the sample. The easy thing is to do a convenience sample, put out requests for people to participate and recruit subjects for the protocol, and then select the best offerers. That's been kind of standard for many studies. The better way is to try and get a representative sample of all the births in the United States. And after several years of consultation with the scientific community, we decided to take the road less traveled and try to get a representative sample of all births in the United States. This is considerably harder, but it is also a far better way to conduct a study of this nature. The sample was drawn for us by this statisticians at the National Center for Health Statistics, same people who do the sampling for the health interview survey and in Haines. And this is what we have as a result. We start with all births in the United States, 4 million, and we've identified 105 locations that will be representative of that sample. We then move for the specific sites to perpetuate the relativeness of that relationship of that sample by selecting neighborhoods and households that are appropriate to maintain the representativeness of that sample. This is what we wind up with. These are the 105 sites where the sample will be recruited. The gold stars, there are seven of them, are the Vanguard centers that were first funded in 2005 to be pilots for much of the study and to be lead organizations for consultation with the scientific community as we develop the protocol in more detail. The red dots are Wave 1 sites. There's about 30 of those. They were added in 2007. And the black dots represent Waves 2 and 3, which are being added in 2008 and 2009 to bring the total to 105 sites. The development of the core protocol has honed in on this visit schedule. We will recruit to the extent we can before women are pregnant. Women who plan to get pregnant very soon, women who are not doing anything to keep from getting pregnant anytime soon, and then the total unexpecteds. But we hope to recruit about one-fourth of the sample before the women get pregnant and have pre-pregnancy baseline measures. The first visit then will be once she knows she's pregnant. This will be a home visit, and then you see the schedule of the rest of the visits. You'll see also a gap between the 12-month and the 3-year visit. We originally had an 18-month visit in that we would love to have, but this is one of the things that had to be sacrificed for financial considerations. In addition to these formal visits, we will be in frequent contact with people in the sample by phone. They will also be keeping a diary of specific experiences as an additional data source for us. We plan to analyze the core hypotheses by the community of investigators participating in the National Children's Study. But we also plan to make available as soon as possible data sets by the study phases, that is, by in relationship to the visit schedule. We will have three different types of these public investigator use data sets. One will be totally anonymous, a limited data set with open access. Another will be de-identified with requirements for investigator access. And then the third will be highly restricted so that it's absolutely impossible to identify anybody with rigorous safeguards. The initial analyses will begin with pregnancy exposure and the newborn data, which will be the first thing that we release and the first thing that we analyze. So we hope that the National Children's Study will provide answers to concerns about known exposures during pregnancy and childhood to potential toxicants. It will have the power to demonstrate absence of effects or even benefit of exposures to various products that are important to our economy. And hopefully we will discover causal factors for a number of diseases and conditions with suspected causes but not proven. We hope that we will have information on how multiple causes interact, including social, cultural, and behavioral factors, to result in a variety of different outcomes. We have the large sample size that's required to analyze and apply knowledge from the human genome study and the genome to understand multifactorial genetic conditions as well as gene-environment interactions. We'll be able to identify early life factors that contribute to adult disorders and have a national resource for future question answering. What's the status? I've told you about the planning efforts that have been going on. From 2001 to 2006, this has been very thorough. It's involved over 3,000 scientists, as I said. In 2005, we established 7 Vanguard centers to work with us in further planning. These are top-notch sites around the country, as well as funding the Data Coordinating Center, which is a contract with Westat. The first targeted funding for the National Children's Study was received from the Congress in 2007. We used that to establish 22 more centers serving 30 locations, what we call Wave 1. We also increased the staffing, equipping, and supplying of the Vanguard centers to get them ready to start enrollment and built the information management system. In 2007, we posted the research plan up through age 24 months on the website, as well as submitting it to the National Academy of Sciences that convened a special expert panel to conduct a peer review of that plan and report back to us. And we've also been working with OMB and getting the clearances necessary. In 2008, we started preparing for the pilot at the Vanguard centers, established laboratories and specimen repository, and funded the 35 additional locations in Wave 2. We're working on that at the present time to get those contracts out by September 30th. In 2009, if we get funding, we will establish the last Wave 3, another 35 locations. We will also begin recruitment of a pilot cohort at the Vanguard sites. This is an interesting feature of this study. January 1st, if all goes well, is our target for starting to recruit this pilot sample at 2 of the sites, and by April we'll have added the other 5 sites as well. This is a pilot cohort of 1,000 subjects who will be continued as a pilot cohort throughout the 21 years of the study. advancing through the boa constrictor about a year ahead of the rest of the main cohort so that we can get bugs out of the system, test things, pilot things, and build on the information that we have gained from that pilot year before we actually go into the field with the full study sample recruitment. So they'll have a year to recruit starting January, and then the year will allow a six-month lag to make any adjustments to the final protocol. And then in July of 2010, we'll begin recruitment of the full cohort at the Wave 1, 2, and then eventually the Wave 3 locations, and hopefully begin starting to publish the first findings from the study. What about funding? For the first 6 years, we used our own funds from the various four lead agencies for this. NICHD, NIEHS, CDC, and EPA put up about $60 million from their funds for the costs of staffing and developing the study to that phase. In 2007, we received our first targeted funding for the National Children's Study from the Congress. They provided the $69 million identified as the target money necessary and provided it quite appropriately to the NIH Office of the Director, specifically earmarked for the NCS, so that the funds are there when we have expenditures, such as funding the contracts for the sites, funding the data center, funding other aspects. We provide requests to the NIHOD, and the funds are provided for that purpose. In 2008, the Congress provided about $111 million, again to the NIH Office of the Director for NCS. And 2009, our projected cost is $192 million. That money is included in the committee actions in both the House and the Senate. Whether we will see that or not, we'll have to wait probably another 6 months or so. After 2010, the projected costs started about $200 million a year for the core activities, and it will eventually start to taper down as the visits become less frequent. The total 27-year cost is about $3.2 billion for the core study. Now, current activities going on include responding to the advice from the National Academy of Sciences Review Committee that basically endorsed the study, said that you're on the right track, this is really important to do, but we have a few suggestions for some things you could do better. So they made about 32 recommendations that we are have been reviewing, and many of them have already been implemented in the time of the year since we submitted the original plan to them for their review and the present. Others are things that we had considered doing but rejected for a variety of reasons, mainly financial cost. Things like using medical record abstraction rather than parent interviews for some of the data, and things like the 18-month visit that we had to eliminate that they thought really should be put back. There are other things that we're still considering ways to implement. We're also looking at the contents of the core protocol data collection and analysis that can be done at $200 million a year level, and identifying potential enhancement add-on studies that can take advantage of this incredible cohort and resource that may never have an opportunity to be done again without the large infrastructure cost. The next steps then are consulting with the NIH institutes, with the CDC, the EPA, and other federal agencies, also with foundations, with advocacy groups, and industry regarding support for these enhancements. Remember that this was envisioned from the start by the Congress and by the planners that said it would be a consortium of federal agencies utilizing public-private partnerships. And then we will hope to get support for these and add the enhancements that we get funding for to the protocol in time for its inclusion. Examples of things that could be added on: the 18-month visit restoration. Looks at alternative medicines and treatments being used in pregnancy and in children. Medical record sources for vaccinations or other important data. Detail on media exposure, much more than we have included at the present time. More detail and depth on exposures related to asthma or diabetes or some other disorders and conditions. more detail on diet than we have included at the present time, as well as measures of access to and use of health care. We're now working with the Foundation for NIH on approaches to the non-government organizations that we are not allowed to approach as a government organization, trying to approach them for funding for enhancements of things of interest to them as well. We'll be visiting with you at the institutes, as well as with other government agencies, to discuss your interest in developing some of these enhancement activities and providing some funds for them. This is nothing new. It's as old as the NIH. We've been doing it, for example, with the Ad Health study that we've been conducting now for 12 years. We've enlisted 22 different institutes, federal agencies, and others as partnerships in funding for the Ad Health study. The National Center for Health Statistics solicits funding for special add-ons or special enhancements for their activities. Most recent one that I've seen was a request from Dr. Hodes in aging for add-on project support from other institutes for the study that they're doing on testosterone supplements for aging men. So you can expect us to be knocking on your door and with some an offer I hope you can't refuse. And will be so appealing that you'll just jump at the opportunity to do it. In addition to these studies, we have plans for adjunct studies as well. We expect to receive investigator-initiated grant applications for both prospective studies requiring additional data collection in all or part of the sample, as well as support for additional analyses of the data set and the stored specimens. Some of your institutes have already been working with the NCS on topics of interest. One example is the National Cancer Institute. Large as the study is, with 100,000 participants, it's still not large enough for analyzing environmental causations of even the most common of the childhood cancers, acute lymphocytic leukemia. You can see here what the calculations show of the size we need. So we've been working with the Cancer Institute on augmenting the study by adding cohorts of pediatric cancer from other places around the world. To do this, we formed an international childhood cancer cohort consortium with large birth and child cohort studies where we can merge the data to achieve a sample size of about 500,000. Terry Dwyer from Australia has been in residence with us, leading the development of this, interacting with a number of other countries, and they have monthly conference call meetings and periodic international meetings to develop this further. So that the NCS will be part of a global activity for this for pediatric cancers. The NCS is not just a U.S. activity. There are other countries that have already collected cohorts, not quite with the intensity of data collection that we anticipate for NCS, but the cohorts that are collected and being studied. And we have other countries. Thanks, Alan. Other studies, countries that have studies in the planning phase. Norway and Denmark each have 100,000 birth cohort samples that are now about 4 or 5 years old. We have been engaged with Canada, wants to use several of its provinces for a study as much like the U.S. study as possible. This summer we had 5 people from the Japanese Ministry of Health come and visit with us to discuss their plans for a 60,000 child cohort in Japan, very much modeled after the U.S. study. Other countries include Brazil, France, China, and some others that are planning similar studies. And to the extent we can make common elements within these studies, we will be able to combine them for stronger analyses. This is contact information for the website for the National Children's Study. Also, I'd like to introduce Dr. Peter Scheidt. Pete, would you stand up? Pete is the study director for the National Children's Study. He's been with us from the beginning, and he's a person that you should get to know to discuss your interest in the NCS and as well as the appropriate program staff that would be interacting with you. Pete has done an incredible job. Not many people could have taken the enormity of this task like Pete has done and bring it to almost implementation with the first subject recruitment like he's done. So he's just done a magnificent job. So that's the National Children's Study, up to date, and opportunities for participation. Now let me go on to some of the other opportunities that exist. And the first of these is newborn screening. This began about 3 years ago as an NICHD initiative, but most recently has been enhanced by the Act of Congress called Newborn Screening Saves Lives, Act of 2008. Basically, it exhorts us and directs us to continue doing what we are doing. And what we are doing is trying to develop new screening methods for individual conditions, as well as common platforms to screen for many of these conditions at once, to save money, to encourage all states to have similar platforms so that what you get screened for doesn't depend on what state you're born in. We also are working to introduce new screening tests very cautiously, with adequate preparation for them being done on a nationwide basis, and developing new treatments for conditions that can be screened for, but for which we don't yet have curative therapy. We have ways to intervene to help. We can make the diagnosis much earlier, but we may not have totally curative or preventive therapy like we have for most of the conditions for which we're screening at the present time. The organization for this is that the Secretary already had an advisory committee on heritable disorders and genetic diseases in newborns and children. The Act of Congress formally establishes that and gives it authority for oversight and actions in introducing new screening tests on a nationwide basis. And we are working quite actively hand-in-hand with that committee in the activities that we're doing. The membership on that committee includes NIH, HRSA, the CDC, ARC, academics, state newborn screening program directors, and professional and advocacy societies. What we're working on now in terms of opportunities for participation include development of a new and improved expanded technology, partly mass spectrometry, which has been the newest introduction, but also looking at microchip arrays, microbeads of Luminex, and a new technology involving microfluidics that looks extremely promising. We're also working on individual test development. We're hoping that we may eventually become able to screen not just for 29 disorders, but for hundreds of disorders. Expanding screening for genetic metabolic disorders associated with mental retardation or neurodegeneration, screening for hemoglobinopathies like sickle cell disease or thalassemia, coagulopathies like hemophilia, immunodeficiency disorders like severe combined immune deficiency, better tests for cystic fibrosis, new tests for muscular dystrophies, hereditary deafness syndromes, and many others. I put some examples on this slide. Here, the person for contact in terms of these and treatment development work is Dr. Jim Hansen, who's over here. Jim, would you stand up? His phone number is here on the slide. There are copies of the slides on the table at the entrance. If you didn't get one as you pick one up, please take one as you leave, because there's some valuable information there about contacts as well as the summaries of what I've been presenting here. So some of you have already been working with us in these, and many more opportunities are possible, and I hope you'll take advantage of those. Next, I'd like to spend a couple minutes on the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children program. This had its origin in action by Congress back in 2002 that was just renewed in 2007, the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act. This goal here is to conduct studies involving off-patent and on-patent drugs or biologicals for unmet children's health needs. The primary target is getting new FDA labeling for the products to enhance the safe use in children, as well as dissemination of this information. This is an NICHD-led program for off-patent drug studies in partnership with the FDA, and we've involved other institutes in this very extensively. Cancer Institute with studies of anti-cancer drugs, the Heart Institute with studies of treatment in children for sickle cell disease, NIMH with studies of Ritalin for ADHD, and the Neurology Institute with studies of anticonvulsants. Here the membership consists of NICHD and FDA program staff with ad hoc collaborators from the institutes as we study compounds of interest to you. Most recently, when the new renewal of this legislation, the focus was broadened from just off-patent drugs and testing to a new approach focused on therapeutic areas and therapeutic needs for children. So here we're going to need your expertise even broader as we hold meetings with stakeholders trying to prioritize areas of study and selecting these therapeutic areas as well as the drugs that will be studied as part of them. I'd like to introduce Don Madison, who's here, who is the head of our program on Best Pharmaceuticals for Children, and contact information, again, is on the slide. Next area is pediatric medical devices. This is also very new legislation, just passed last year. It's a legislation called Pediatric Medical Device Safety and Improvement Act of 2007. Its purpose is to try to stimulate research to develop devices for pediatric use in prevention, diagnosis, mitigation, or cure. It's comparable in some ways to the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act, but here the emphasis is on working with the scientific community and industry to develop or adapt devices for children rather than testing existing products like drugs for pediatric use. So we're encouraged to work with the Small Business Innovation Research Program and the small business community and manufacturers, as well as engineers and other people who work on medical devices to expand the possibilities for use for children. There's a trans-NIH group with participation of 12 institutes that's co-chaired by NICHD and NHLBI. So far, in keeping with the requirements in the legislation, they've solicited information from the community through an RFI, held a stakeholders workshop this summer, and developed the required research plan mandated by the legislation that's due to be submitted to the Congress October 1st. The opportunities here are really going to be implementation of the research plan that's been developed. And here again, there's major activities and possibility for all of the 12 institutes that are currently doing anything in research with medical devices. The lead person for that is Dr. Steve Hirschfeld. Unfortunately, I can't introduce him because he's deployed in hurricane territory with the Public Health Service emergency response team and didn't get back here in time and probably will stay now in Texas after being in Louisiana. Another relatively new program but didn't have its origins in Congress but with the NIH is the Biomarkers Consortium. Here, the origin was with the NIH roadmap and the FDA's critical path. Its goal is to quantify new biological markers for public use by researchers, regulators, and healthcare providers. It's a public-private partnership, organized in this case by the Foundation for the NIH, because they can interact directly with industry where we have to do it indirectly. They've formed four topic area steering committees that report to an executive committee. The membership includes government, industry, academia, and patient advocacy and nonprofit private sector organizations. The efforts here are to propose projects that are screened initially by the executive committee, and if selected for implementation, they go on to a steering committee. There are pediatric opportunities that are discussed all during this selection process, and we have a roster and reservoir of pediatric experts to participate in these steering committee activities. So far, they've reviewed 11 possible topics, and three are actually underway. Here there are opportunities to submit new project concepts, particularly of interest to us, are those focused on pediatric issues. And again, Dr. Steve Hirschfeld is our point of contact, who is not here. The last of these opportunities that I want to mention is the Pediatric Oversight Committee within the Clinical and Translational Science Awards. The origin here is the NIH Roadmap and the National Center for Research Resources. Here, the Oversight Committee provides a unique national forum for investigators within the funded CTSAs and NIH scientists working with this program to facilitate pediatric and translational research. They do this by identifying barriers and setting priorities for their work, recommending strategies to implement across the CTSAs to the steering committee, and coordinating consortium-wide approaches to pediatric research. The organization here is a standing committee with oversight for pediatric activities that reports through the CTSA principal investigators. Here, they select their own chair. Currently, it's Jennifer Puck, formerly of NHGRI, and now at the University of California, San Francisco. And it includes three NIH co-chairs from NCRR, from NHLBI, and from NICHD. They have seven different work groups that are listed here. They have also other committees and working groups that are expected to have at least one pediatric member. Membership is open to anyone from a CTSA site, but actions taken by the pediatric oversight group can be voted on with just one vote per site and three votes from the NIH, where we have about 12 different institutes that are engaged with the pediatric oversight committee. The process here has included quarterly teleconferences and monthly teleconferences of the subworking groups. We've also held a national conference on IRB challenges in evaluating pediatric research, and they're working on a pediatric ethics consult group and establishing a central IRB in pediatrics. They're also planning a pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry CTSA dialogue for December of this year. So your opportunities here are collaborative pediatric research projects. In particular, the opportunities for using the CTSA network for multi-site clinical trials, as well as project and policy and process development. Here again, the contact is Steve Hirschfeld from NICHD, as well as Susan Schurin from NHLBI, and staff from the NCRR. So, in conclusion, there are presently an unprecedented large number of opportunities that exist for trans-NIH collaboration in pediatric research. These opportunities represent ways to improve our understanding and treatment of diseases in children, as well as, and this is extremely important, preventing their manifestation in adults. Many institutes are already participating in these activities, but there's room for many more to join in. And keeping in mind that these interventions in childhood may represent the greatest opportunity to prevent or ameliorate adult disease. That's the presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions or get any comments from you.
Well, thank you very much, Duane, and this is open for discussion now. We would like to have a lively discussion, but while you're thinking of your questions and comments, let me start with one. I'd like to connect the beginning of your talk and the end of your talk. I've been fascinated, and we can get into more about the National Children's Study funding, but obviously the starts and potential funding issues there. But the CTSAs are a huge investment by the NIH and the American people in our academic infrastructure. The National Children's Study, by design, very appropriately, has to be where the patients or the individuals are being born, out in the community. It seems like we really need ways to connect the intellectual power we have in our academic centers and the CTSAs with what's going to go on in these obviously decentralized areas with waves of new patients being born. I wonder how that committee from the CTSAs may help in this, or where the National Children's Study may be thinking about how to really bring these two efforts and align them better.
Yeah. Alan, that's a very important observation and question that we have given some thought to. Already there's overlap between the existing CTSAs and the sites where the study is going to be conducted and the centers that are in charge of those. Pete, what's the overlap at the present time? I heard you give a figure recently about that number. Do you remember what it is?
We think it's about 60 to 70% of the centers in the National Children's Study are also at centers that participate in with the CTSA.
Yeah.
So it's quite substantial.
Yeah. And Pete and I were just talking this morning about some of the common activities from the CTSAs, the Pediatric Oversight Group, and what we're doing from the National Children's Study. Collection of common biospecimens, collection of certain databases, some information that they're talking about collecting at the CTSAs that's comparable to or even identical to what we're going to be collecting in the NCS. The big difference is that the NCS is observational, not interventional. It will collect information on interventions, but it will not conduct them. But many of the children who are going to be enrolled at the sites for the NCS are also likely to be enrolled in some of the studies that are going to be done at the CTSAs. So it's very important that those communications stay open. It's also, the CTSAs are going to be bigger, not just in pediatrics, but overall than the NCS. The CTSAs are projected $500 million a year in funding. Now, not all that's going to pediatrics. Not nearly enough of it will, but we'll get as much as we can. And we're projecting the base cost, the central core cost of NCS, at about $200 million plus the enhancements. So your observation is quite correct and something that we are aware of and thinking about ways to promote that interaction. And we welcome other thoughts from people about that as well. Pete, do you want to add anything?
We are scheduled to attend at least on a one-time basis, the meeting of the pediatric group and the informatics group, and there are various subcommittees that we'll be participating in. But it strikes me that a more intentional and coordinated effort would make sense for the steering committee of the National Children's Study to plan a more in-depth meeting with the pediatric committee of the CTSAs and lay out a strategy for mutual collaboration and taking advantage of this overlap. The National Children's Study is observational, but that is a platform on which interventional studies can well be conducted with a great deal of leverage additional information collected that would otherwise, you know, not be available and be far too expensive to, you know, to do. So there's enormous opportunities.
My name is Debbie. I was most excited about the fact that you really have a globalization going with the data collection efforts. We don't have very many studies that actually put that much effort into the global factors. And I realize that in a short period of time, you can't address everything. So I was wondering if you could address are you oversampling minorities in the United States in order to make comparisons on the global factor of different racial ethnic groups in order to determine if there are racial ethnic differences based upon Americanization factors?
Good question, one that we get often. The sample was drawn as a representative sample of all births in the U.S. So the basic sample is not oversampled for any group. However, there are some areas where we are certainly going to be collecting an intensive sample. Several of our collection sites are Indian reservations, for example, a population that's very rarely adequately sampled in studies. And we're also making arrangements to be sure that we get the adequate representation that this geographic distribution in this sample provides. Pete, you want to add anything about that?
Yes, the only oversample that we did was in rural locations because they are typically understudied and because of the low population in the rural counties that were selected for the sample, we went from the 23% of counties that are rural throughout the U.S. to a 27% of rural counties in the NCS sample. The sampling statisticians advised us that it was not necessary to oversample for minority groups in the National Children's Study because the sample size is sufficiently large to not have to do that and still be able to study the major low socioeconomic groups in the study. And That's necessary when you do a national sample on the size of 18,000 to 20,000, which is a typical household survey in Haines, in order to be able to study underserved communities. You have to oversample, but with 100,000, we were advised that we didn't, and we would be better served by having a truly representative sample in order to protect the representativeness of the experience from different exposures that are distributed differently throughout the entire country, and to not risk missing key exposures.
So can I just follow up with a question to what you just said? So if that's the case, then there are environmental conditions, for instance, like in L.A., in inner-city L.A., in which Hispanic population has gone from 25th in ranking of brain cancers in any kind of population groups to number one. And it doesn't seem that if there's not some targeting over sampling on issues like this, you're not going to be able to capture sort of very critical health issues for different population groups. And it may not be a variant of SES.
Well, L.A. Represents four PSUs for the National Children's Study. It's so large that it's a certainty location anyway, and will always be included in any national sample. And in fact, we have we have L.A. times four in the National Children's Study because it's so large. But still, to look at cancer in that population the numbers will still be too small because the frequency of cancer is so small that we'd have to have a very large study focused just on LA to be able to look at that at all. And so I suspect even with the size of the sample in the National Children's Study, we won't be able to look at that outcome from just LA.
Could you say a little bit more about how the ICs can add to these studies? So are the samples being collected in such a way that the studies that would be supported in addition to what's already being planned involve just access to tissue samples, or do you also envision ICs really being able to fund the additional questions, additional measures along the whole 21 years of data collection? And how does that work, if you understand what I'm asking?
It would work in both ways. We're very interested in the extent to which an institute has an interest in additional data collections for the entire study that are above and beyond what we could either afford or be able to do without additional support. And we're certainly receptive to the notion of filling in some gaps that will certainly occur as a consequence of just the limitations of our resources. In addition, we're providing the opportunity for ICs and other investigators from around the country to propose additional adjunct studies on portions, on subsamples, one or two or however many centers, to do more intense types of measures, either biologic or of any type, as adjunct studies that would be available. And the process for proposing those studies is developed. It's available on the website and available now. And we envision that such proposals will come from investigators at the centers, from investigators in laboratories here at NIH or CDC or wherever, There are approximately 200 of such adjunct studies that occurred in the Women's Health Initiative, not funded by NHLBI, but from other sources. We anticipate more than that in the National Children's Study. So both avenues are, certainly possible and encouraged.
I'll take another one if.
Please do.
So one of the things that always happens at NIH is that we oftentimes focus on disease and disorders. And I realize that, this is just a presentation. Could you talk a little bit about how the study will look at healthy behavior or health factors, not just the disease and disorder, behavior problems kinds of things?
Well, certainly this is a longitudinal study of different life stages, and there's enormous opportunity for understanding the trajectory of human development in this study, and many of the measures that we're doing will focus on that. I'm smiling because that was a specific concern raised by the National Academy of Sciences that felt that the National Children's Study should be more focused on healthy development than it is, and we've had a working group on healthy development. One of those working groups that Dr. Alexander referred to, focused to some extent on healthy development. We have hypotheses on healthy development, but to actually reemphasize that issue, we're reconstituting a working team that will further emphasize healthy development and develop the conceptual frameworks for that in more detail. We do feel that the National Academy of Sciences review felt that the disease model was overemphasized and the healthy development model was underemphasized. We did not agree with that. We think the study was conceptualized because of concerns about environmental things doing bad, hurting children, and that charge, cannot be less emphasized, but we think it's important to increase the emphasis on healthy development, and we're engaging in that as we speak.
I have one more. Could you talk about... I'm also excited that there's this emergence of the pharmaceutical aspect to the study because I think that that's critical. Could you talk a little bit about how in the pharmaceutical aspect of things that you're looking at the same sort of issues that we have to deal with adults in pharmaceuticals in children, such as body weight differences and racial and ethnic differences in how they metabolize different drugs?
We certainly understand and expect that pharmaceuticals will be a class of exposure of importance in the National Children's Study as it relates to growth, development, cognitive development, and other disease outcomes. And where those kinds of outcomes will be available in the National Children's Study, and we do plan to collect data about pharmaceutical exposures. The nomenclature system that we're proposing to use is one called Lexicon. That is one of the standardized databases for pharmaceutical data collection. And so those exposure, i.e. pharmaceutical exposures and outcomes relationships, will be available. We do not have specific hypotheses for mechanisms of those relationships, and to the extent that investigators and ICs are interested in those, that would be a perfect opportunity for more in-depth adjunct study type proposals.
Well, I want to thank Duane for getting OPASI rounds off to a really great second year. Thank you for your presentation. I want to thank Pete for his comments and all of you for coming today. Have a good weekend.